listening to Miller & Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network. And now, here's Mark Miller and David Moulton.
Final hour of the show for those of you in Lake City and surrounding areas. Tampa, St. Pete, Port Charlotte, and Venice. We're just halfway home in the 239. Miller & Moulton, Florida Sports Network, floridasportsnetwork.com. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the show Mike Westhoff, who describes himself as a former coach and cancer survivor, but he's now an author. He's written the book, Figure It Out. You can follow Mike on Twitter at ST Coach Mike, ST for special teams, Coach Mike. Mike, welcome. How are you?
I'm great, guys. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
All right. Well, we do this. This is the very simple question we ask everybody that's done this. Why'd you write a book, Mike?
Okay. It's something I always thought that I'd like to do. It maybe goes back to my education. You know, I have my master's degree in education with an emphasis on psychology, and I always liked figuring out what makes things work and what makes people tick. And then as I got involved into what I did in my NFL career, it was in a metamorphosis type, you know, procedure. It kept changing. And so I always thought it would be a fun thing to write about. It didn't exactly go the way I had planned it, to be honest, but it's just something I thought I would want to do and that I would. And then, of course, during after I retired from the NFL, from the New Orleans Saints, and that was enough for me. I had 32 years, and the pandemic came along. I just got into it. I started, and I worked straight through almost 2.5 years till I finished.
Well, you said it turned out differently than what you always envisioned it to be. In what way?
Okay. When I first got into coaching, it had nothing to do with special teams. Please. I mean, I was an offensive line coach. I played as a player, as an outside linebacker, and then sometimes as an offensive center. I had a good college career. I'm proud of it. But never special teams. I didn't know anything. And then next thing you know, I'm at the Baltimore Colts. I was the strength coach because they needed one, all right, which I didn't want to do, but I got into it, and I knew it would move on. I coached tight ends. I helped at the offensive line, things like that. And all of a sudden, Frank Cush one day during the 1982, during the player strike, came to me, and we were actually jogging in Towson, Maryland. And he stopped, and we took a walk, and he said he was going to fire our special teams coach. He thought he just couldn't do the job. And I had talked him out of firing him, which might not have been the smartest thing I ever did, but because the guy was a pain in the neck, but I did it. And I said, I'll take it over. I'll do it. Okay, go ahead. You got it. Whoa. So here I am now, a special teams coach in the NFL, totally by accident. The good thing for me is that we were on strike, so I could sort of start to figure it out. I inherited a notebook. It should have come with crayons. I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, there's nothing. I'm trying to, what is this? So that's how I started. And then little by little by little, I started to figure it out. And then I really kind of got into it because of the fact there was, at the time, no special teams coordinators, very little innovation, very little, and zero regulation. So I sort of figured out you can kind of do anything you want. You just try it. And I became very creative. And it was like I had a whole part of the football game to myself, that this is the way I looked at it. So I can do whatever I want. Just figure this stuff out. Develop a philosophy and make it work. And I got into it, and it became a real passion. And then I loved the fact of taking the underdog, the guy that nobody knew about, which is kind of a way I always viewed myself as a player or whatever. I started school very young. You know, you read it, Mark. You know what I'm talking about. I was young. I was a little intimidated, but I figured it out. Next thing you know, you can have a realm of success. And so I fell in love with it.
Well, Mike, I do want to get into one part of the book that I don't think that I knew nothing about you having a relationship with. You being with the Colts, you were part of the move. You were there when the Mayflower Movers came. So just give us a little background on that infamous day in football history.
Sure. Keep in mind, remember, first of all, the city of Baltimore had dramatically changed. You know, they were on hard economic times. The textile industry had basically fled. I think it was Sparrow's Point was the big steel mill. It had closed. you know, they were on hard times. The city, the stadium was old. You know, the famous storied Colts were a thing of the past. You know, the players had gotten old. The stadium was a mess. They really didn't have. They had the least non-shared revenue in the NFL. That's where Baltimore was. All right, so it was kind of a mess. And the rumors were out of a move. And so some cities started to buy a little bit. There was talk that we were going to go to Phoenix. Memphis came along. Jacksonville was being discussed. And in Indianapolis, with Lilly, the drug company, built the Hoosier Dome. They built the dome. Well, you know, they've got a nice stadium sitting there. Well, then negotiations were going around. Everybody was thinking it might happen. And then one late afternoon, Jimmy Irsay, the owner's son, who was the acting general manager, came around to us. And when I say us, believe me, a small handful of people in that building, a couple of the, most of the coaches, there was one coach excluded, two film guys, two trainers, a couple equipment guys, and that's it. Said, stick around, guys. We're going to have a meeting tonight. So around 6 o'clock after everybody left, everybody went home. We gathered together for a meeting. He said, there'll be boxes put in your office. The trucks are coming tonight. They're on their way. Indianapolis Mayflower Movers are headquartered in Indiana. They rendezvoused a number of their moving trucks at a truck stop on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. They brought in a small busload of manpower workers, and they told us they're coming in. We're packed everything in your office, everything but the telephone. Everything, we're going tonight. You see, the city of Baltimore owned the building. The Colts leased it from them. So they wanted to get everything out before they could lock the door. We'd have no, the draft was coming up. We had all our draft records. You know, we were getting ready for the draft, all those types of things. So that's why we went at night. And then the truck started to come in, and we just packed everything in the building. Now, I was a strength coach, so I had to disassemble a weight room. You know, good luck, Mike. You know, it was sort of rainy. The weights were all rusted. Oh, it was a mess. But it was like, they were like ants. They took everything in the building. And as soon as the truck was packed, another one came in. And then they just moved. And then we got everything out. They rendezvoused back. The Indiana State Police escorted them to Indianapolis. And then a couple days later, we, you know, came. I remember going back to the building the next day, and now everybody showed up for work, and there was lots of yelling. There were plenty of tears. And it was a difficult time. It was a tough time. The city of Baltimore was furious. The mayor was furious, you know, because he wanted to have a, he believed he had right of first refusal. He did not, as it turned out. And the Colts took an offer and went to Indiana. And now, you know, Indianapolis opened up with this nice new stadium and new radio deals. And they went from having the least non-shared revenue to having right at the very top. You know, it was a good move. Good move for the Irsays. A tough move for people involved. You know, for us as coaches, you know, we go where the job is. And that's how it happened. I remember leaving, trying to drive out, and all these people were gathered at the gate. They weren't going to let me get out. I remember stopping, and I said, guys, this wasn't my idea. I do what I'm told. I said, so get the hell out of the road. Let me go home. And so that's just the truth. That's how the whole thing worked. And it came that fast. We actually found out around 5 or 6 o'clock that the trucks were on their way that night. And no one else in the building ever knew.
Mike Westhoff, retired coach, cancer survivor, and now author. And you can follow him on Twitter at @stcoachmike. The book is Figure It Out. Figure It Out. Listen, you've got a lot of stories, and we could literally do hours with you. I just want to ask a simple question. How did you end up with Coach Shula?
Okay. After I was with the Colts, and Frank Cush kind of fell out of favor with the players, and it was a mess, which is a shame because I had tremendous respect for Frank, and he put together a very good coaching staff. Had we been able to do the draft the way we wanted in 1982, we would have drafted Dan Marino with the first pick as coaches. John Elway was taken. John didn't really want to go to Baltimore, and that, you know, the mess that ended up. Okay, so anyway, I leave the Colts. When Frank Cushy goes in the USFL out to the Arizona Outlaws, I went with him as the offensive line coach. It only lasted for 1 year, and then the USFL faded and came to an end. Coach Shula, they had gotten beat in the playoffs and were coaching the Pro Bowl. And Don was looking for a special teams coach that could coach tight ends. Ron Stark was the Pro Bowl punter. He had played for me at Indianapolis. I actually drafted him. He was our first pick in the second round in 1982 out of Florida State, the great athlete and great punter. Ron told Don Shula, he said, Mike Westhoff's pretty good. He's a good coach. Don Shula called me. So would you be interested? And, you know, yes, sir. I'll start walking today when you're calling. And I went to Miami. It really, to be honest with you, it wasn't much of an interview because you really didn't interview with Don Shula. Don Shula told you how the job was going to be done. That was the interview. He said, look, this is how we do it. Yes, sir, I can do that. And Coach Shula hired me, and I coached tight ends. I helped at the offensive line. Our offensive line coach, John Sandusky, had gotten a little bit older, and he had some health issues, so I did a lot of that and coached the special teams. And then Coach Shula and I would do that, and that began my relationship with him. Anything with Don Shula starts off tough. It's not easy. He was tough. But you had to earn everything. And over a period of time, I did that with him and became very close to him. And I'm proud to say, as I mentioned in my book a lot of times, I used the phrase with guys who played for me, my guys, I became one of his guys. And I'll always be very, very proud of that.
And, you know, I told you this, Mike, when we talked on the phone. I've only met Coach Shula in person once. When he walked into a room, he commanded a presence. Whether it just was something about Don Shula walking into a room, you knew he was there. I can't imagine it was much different when he coached.
No, it really wasn't. Yeah, he was a great student of the game. He was one of those few coaches in NFL history, and I'm talking today included, that could walk into any meeting room and take over the meeting. I mean, he could teach everybody. I mean, he could teach the defensive backs how to play. He could teach the linebackers how to read. He could do it all. And he called plays. He called plays from the sideline with no script. He memorized it. He would call from the sideline with no script. Now, he had help. Don Strock used to help him a little bit. And, of course, Marino, you know, Dan would help him when they weren't yelling at each other, which was so much fun. I loved it. And they loved each other. They had a tremendous relationship. But they were both so competitive. And it was I think I did a good job of capturing a lot of what Don Shula was like and how he did it. As I described him, he wasn't the head coach of the Miami Dolphins. He was the head coach of the National Football League. At that time, he was first and nobody was second. And that's a time when coaches ran the business.
He's Mike Westhoff. Mike, I got to stop you short. We're up against a hard break. Back with more with Coach Westhoff and more on his book, Figure It Out, on the other side. Miller and Moulton, thanks for listening. The Florida Sports Network.
You're listening to Miller and Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network.
Back with more with Mike Westhoff, author of Figure It Out. You can follow him on Twitter at ST Coach Mike. ST, think special teams, Coach Mike.
Coach, wanted to talk to you about Coach Bryant because two things. One, you said in your book you always wanted to transferred. Mike Westhoff was doing the transfer portal before anybody was doing the transfer portal because that's the way things worked out with him playing college. But you said one of your regrets was you wanted to transfer to Alabama and you didn't. That is one. And two, talk about your chance meeting with Coach Bryant.
Yeah, I did. I thought I went to the University of Wyoming, which I really liked. I was happy. I came out, you know, I was young when I came out of school. I was undersized. And I ended up at Wyoming. And I loved it. And they were a really good football team. I mean, they were good. But what they were doing was a little shaky. You know, I mean, freshmen weren't eligible. And we had 105 freshman football players. And at the end of that year, winter during the year, they would cut guys, and they decided out of the 100, they would keep 23 on scholarship. Well, I was the 23rd player. That's what he told me. Lloyd Eaton said, "Yeah, Mike, you're number 23." Well, it frustrated me, and I wanted to transfer. Alabama was playing kind of a fast ball at the time, and I should have transferred there. I wanted to do it. All right, but I didn't. Okay. I'm coaching at Northwestern. I'm on a vacation down at the Panhandle. As my wife and I were driving back, headed up back to Chicago, I said, I've always wanted to visit the university. Let's take a drive over. So we did. In the middle of July, I stop. I find the field house, and I go inside. No one was there. It was empty. It was pitch dark inside. And I'm walking around. I saw the trophies. You know, it was old and storied and really tremendous. I see a light at the end of the hall, and I walk down, and there's Bear Bryant sitting at his desk by himself. He had his white short-sleeve shirt on. He had a tie, his open collar, and he looked up, and he said, "Can I help you?" And I went in. I said, "Yes, sir." I went in and sat down, and he said, "Well, sit down. Let's talk." And he told me nobody was here. Everybody was on vacation, and he was doing some paperwork. And we talked about myself, about, you know, where I went to school and where I played and, you know, all that kind of stuff and where I was coaching currently. And he said, "Do you want to take a look around?" "Oh, yeah, what are you going to do?" "Bear Bryant, yes, sir." He got up. He put on his houndstooth hat. It was the greatest. He said, "Come on." We walked outside. He went into this where the practice field were. He showed me this tower. He said, "I spend most of my time there coaching." He said, "You know, I'm getting older. I don't get around as well as I used to. I get tired." And he said, "So I do most of my stuff there now." And then we started walking, and he was showing me these different buildings on the campus. He said, "See, that's the new library." He said, "We built that wing," meaning football money. He said, "There's a new addition." And he was so proud of the university and what they had done. And as we were walking, he said, "Do you mind if we take a rest?" He said, "I get tired." And we sat down on a curb under a tree. Bear Bryant and me, totally by accident. And he wiped his brow with his handkerchief, and he said, "You know, I get tired. I don't feel as good." And we started talking, and he said, "I'm going to give you a piece of advice. He said, "I want you to do two things in your coaching career." He said, "You want to do this well?" He said, "Don't be afraid to change." He said, "Sometimes the worst mistakes that I've made is when I held back on change. I was hesitant." He said, "All right, that's when I've goofed up." He said, "You got to be ready to change." And he said, "I decided to make a change that was the biggest change that this university in this state maybe ever made." I think anyone would know what I'm talking about. Is he decided that he was going to recruit Afro-American football players and give everyone a chance. And he talked about that a little bit. He said, "Don't be afraid to change." And then he told me, he said, "The better the player is, the harder you can coach him." He said, "Good players want pushed." He said, "You might not always be the most popular guy. If you want to be the best, don't forget that." We got up. I helped him up. Walked. Back to his office. He asked me where I was driving. He said, "You're going to go through Birmingham." I said, "Yes, sir." He called this little restaurant. It was a barbecue place. And he said, "Now you get off." And he told the guy, he said, "Look, I got a coach coming in here with his wife." He said, "Give him a barbecue dinner and put it on my tab." I went back and went to that little restaurant and ate there. And it was just a fortuitous thing that happened to me. I took a crazy chance, but it helped change a lot of my life as a coach.
That is a great story, Mike, and we've known you for a long time, and we never knew that you crossed paths with the great Bear Bryant, and that was wonderful. There are many stories like that. The book is Figure It Out. Figure It Out, widespread distribution in July. Mike, quickly, we still have a few minutes left, but quickly, where can people get it now if they want it?
Yeah, you can get it now through the publisher, which is Mascot. Mascot Books, M-A-S-C-O-T. You go into Mascot Books in the search area, put in the title of the book, Figure It Out, and it'll tell you how to buy it different ways, a hardcover, soft cover. It can be delivered right to your house. You can get it right now. I'm proud. I think it's a very good book. I really do. I love the interviews. And then it'll be anywhere in July, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera. But Mascot Books, right now, they'll deliver it right to your house. I think it's worth it. It's a cool story. That part of the game does not exist today. And you're going to hear me tell the story, but then you're going to hear Zach Thomas tell it, or Taysom Hill tell it, or Sean Payton tell it, you know, or Larry Izzo tell it, or Rosie McDuffie tell it. It's, to me, I love the way that I did the book, and I'm extremely proud.
Mike, now that you're retired, would you do it all over again?
Oh, yeah, in a second. In a second. Are you kidding me? It's the greatest job in the world. I mean, I was so lucky. How did it happen for me? You earn your way. If you do it right, you earn your way out of that stadium. When I would come out of there and I'd look up and there'd be 80,000 people, and I knew there were millions more watching on TV, and I had a chance to be part of that, oh, come on, I'm the luckiest guy ever. There's not. I used to get so excited. I had so much fun, and we were good. We were good at doing it, and I kind of knew that. So, you know, for me, it was a little bit of cockiness with it, too. It was just such a unique part to be a part of, a business. And so, I would do it for a second. In a second, I'd do it all over again. I don't ever regret any moment, ever. Oh, there's some people I ran into, as you read about in a book, that, you know, I wouldn't want to walk across the street. I wanted to kill them half the time. But, boy, most of the guys, oh, wow, it was the greatest. The greatest. Not too many players. I regret every very, very few players ever. There's a couple of people I worked with I wasn't too happy about, but most of the players, I love them. It was fun.
Mike, get in line, Mike. Get in line with that one.
I understand. I got you. That's a good one. You're right.
Mike, congratulations on the book. As you get closer to publish it, we talked about it during the break. I'd like to have you in the studio and come back one more time for a few more stories and to talk more about the book. But, Mike, really thank you for the time today. Thanks for the stories and always being a good sport with us. Have a great day and good luck with the book.
All right, guys, thank you. Thanks for having me. You're the greatest.
Mike Westhoff, the book is Figure It Out, Mascot Publishing, if you want to get it now. Full release in 2 months' time. You can follow Coach Mike Westhoff on Twitter at ST Coach Mike. ST Coach Mike.
It is a long book. It's 400 plus pages, but it is a very easy read.
Yeah, but this is what we have been told by our audience over 15 years that they want. They want the stories. They want to learn about the people, the personalities. You know, we can get the games on TV. We can't get all the other stuff.
No doubt. No doubt. And you get a lot of it in there. Didn't even get into the Woody Hayes stuff that's in there. He coached with Lee Corso when he was getting his grad degree at Indiana. So, I mean, you're just starting to scratch the surface of this. His stories have stories, as we like to say, David.
Plus, he had that long NFL career, whether it was Shula, Jimmy Johnson, Dave Wannstedt, Rex Ryan and the Jets, agonizingly close to the Super Bowl. Never got the ring.
Never got to the game.
No, his last full year was that controversial Saints-Rams NFC title game when the Saints got hosed. Would have at least gotten to the game if they had gotten the call right. Miller and Moulton, the Florida Sports Network.
You're listening to Miller and Moulton, exclusively on the Florida Sports Network.
Before our week is done in Tampa, St. Pete, Lake City, and Port Charlotte and Venice. Of course, the bonus hour at the top of the hour for those in the 239. Miller and Moulton, the Florida Sports Network. Our poll question today, floridasportsnetwork.com. Which team are you on? Which team are you siding with? Team Jimbo, Team Nick? Right now, a bit of a runaway. Team Jimbo, over 70%. Go to floridasportsnetwork.com. Josh Pate's kind enough to join us. Covers college football for a living, 24/7 sports. CBS Sports HQ, host of the Late Kick podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Late Kick Josh. Josh, it's David and Mark once again. Thanks for your time. Well, we can just start there. This is all unfolded in the last 24, 36 hours. If you had to answer our poll question, which box you checking?
I'd be smart enough to hit the X and get out of there before anyone got me on record with that. Or I would do the write-in, and I would just write in Team College Football or Team Josh. Because Team Josh really won yesterday more so than either one of those entities did.
You know what? You're not wrong. And Team Miller and Moulton won yesterday, too, because if we're talking college football, at the middle of May, because we had two coaches throwing emergency pressers to first bash one another and then one to come out and play the apology game. Hey, just, Josh, how surprised were you that Nick went on the offensive like this?
I wasn't surprised that he felt the way he did. I was stunned that he actually named names, I guess, for lack of a better term. you know, I did a lot of reaching out yesterday to a lot of people around that program. I kind of had a suspicion. I wanted to see if I could get it validated, and I did. When I watched him, and I've been in a closed setting with him before. I've been in an off-the-record setting and then plenty of on-the-record settings. You heard Nick Saban in a typical fashion for him in an off-the-record setting. You heard him in what he would sound like in a closed environment. If he were talking just to donors or alumni or a certain group of people, but there weren't cameras present, that's pretty much Nick Saban, and that's not just him. That's how most coaches talk at those kind of functions. It's kind of like a pep rally, so to speak. And so you got that. Well, I obviously, since we saw the footage, realized, oh, it wasn't closed. Did he think it was closed to the media? Well, it turns out that's one of those events where it was supposed to be 10-minute media session, sweep the room, then we'll start the event. The only problem is, as you saw, the media did not get swept. And I don't think Nick Saban realized that. Now, to his part, you shouldn't have said what you said either way, but I realized very quickly he does not know he's being recorded, does he? Now, in 2022, that's never an excuse, but I listened to that, and then I knew, knowing Jimbo Fisher, I knew immediately he's going to answer. There is no force of nature in College Station, Texas, that could have stopped him from running to the nearest microphone. And talking to some folks out there, not everyone was on board with him calling that press conference yesterday. It was so impromptu. Not only was he wearing jeans, they also did not. They didn't even have time to get the right sponsored water bottle up there. There was no label on the water bottle he was drinking from. So that's how impromptu that was. I tried to think that, and I could not, off the top of my head, come up with a more surreal 12 to 24 hour exchange publicly between head coaches like that. I don't remember it.
A friend of ours, Bud Elliott, I'm sure a friend of yours, he said he has to go back to when John Chaney stormed Calipari's press conference post game of Temple UMass in the early 90s, the last time he can remember, when two Hall of Fame coaches, I mean, let's face it, Jimbo's going to go into the Hall of Fame too, when two Hall of Fame coaches are going after one another this way. We're talking with Josh Pate, College Football, 24/7 Sports, CBS Sports HQ, host of the Late Kick podcast. Follow him on Twitter at Late Kick. Josh, okay, but say everything you said is 100% factual. Nick has to know we can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So why is he not ready to just move on? He can be the best at whatever the game is. So he gets beat for 1 year. He can adjust. He can have that recruiting class next year. I don't understand why he's this bent.
Well, I'll give you my interpretation. When I've watched him in the past get bent out of shape with things only to then adjust and dominate using those things, I think in his mind, I really believe he draws a hard line in the sand between what kind of offense you run or, you know, what kind of quarterback you're going to use and all that stuff. That's just on the field stuff versus the fundamental way that talent acquisition happens. And he's not alone in this. A lot of guys feel this way. He's just the one who's been outspoken about it. I think he looks at it and says, yeah, have I complained in the past? Yeah. I complained about the functionality of the game, though. And when I didn't get in my way, I just adjusted and I dominated in the game. To him, I think this zooms way out from that, and it's more total in nature. It's more all-encompassing in nature, and it's the fabric of the game itself. I know people scoff at that. I know good and well there are people driving around down there in Florida rolling their eyes at that. I'm not telling you how to feel. I'm telling you how I believe he feels. And I think that he's kind of like some of the college basketball coaches that you've seen step away from the game recently. And they look at it and they say, look, there's a lot we've adjusted to. But we adjusted to basketball things. This latest thing that's come along with the way NIL works, a lot of people view as just a tearing of the curtain that's been the backdrop of what college athletics has been. And a lot of them feel if that's going to be the way it is moving forward, that's not college athletics, or at least not the college athletics that I want to be associated with. And that's why you see I thought the biggest takeaway between, ironically, Jimbo and Saban was what they agreed on. Both of them readily acknowledged we need federal assistance here because our governing body cannot do anything to police the sport. And sadly, we have to look to the federal level if we're going to salvage some sort of what college athletics have been in our careers.
Do you think this is a step for Nick then to step down in the near future? I mean, do you think, obviously the transfer portal, Josh, he's killed it. He's got four starters coming into the transfer portal. This doesn't affect the Alabama one iota when it comes to that end of it. But NIL, he's not very happy about, doesn't like the way the direction they're going in. How long are we going to have Nick Saban coaching?
Well, I did a segment about 2 weeks ago. I had a viewer ask, do you feel like, you know, the shifting sands of college athletics, do you feel like we're going to see more coaches leave? And I think the answer is yes. Maybe that is Saban somewhere down the road. I mean, he's nearing, we think, he's nearing retirement age anyway. But I think there's coming a time where we do see a chain reaction in college football like we have seen in college basketball over just the last couple of years. And I don't just think it's Saban. I'm listening to a lot of these guys. You don't have to know them off the record. They say it on the record. Dabo Swinney has been outspoken about this. Saban's been outspoken about it. Kirby Smart's been outspoken about it. I'm not saying all these guys were about to step away, but yes, I could easily see if this continues to go the direction it's going, and we don't have someone grab the wheel, and the bus just continues to careen towards the cliff, I could see several high-profile coaches say, you know what? I see the money they're handing out for people to do TV. I'm already financially secure. I don't recognize the future of this sport. I'll just go sit in the broadcast booth and work one-tenth of my annual schedule and probably double my salary in the process because that's the way TV contracts work these days. Yes. Yeah, I could easily see that happening.
Well, in fact, one of those guys may be Dan Mullen. I mean, Dan Mullen's coaching for a high school this year. He's relocated, and he's made plenty of money, and Dan's like 49 years old. Dan could have a 15, 20-year TV career, and Dan would be good on TV. I think, Josh, you're more than scratching the surface here. Okay, could you humor me, Josh, for 10 seconds? The three of us are congressmen, all right? And we actually know the issues, or we think we do. We're going to sit down and put together a piece of legislation. I just don't understand what we could put on paper that would not get overturned in the courts, if you know what I mean, to fix the big problem that NIL has created.
Yeah, it's antitrust is what it has to be. But then once I say those words, then I put on my Jimbo Fisher hat and I say, And I'm not smart enough to figure all that out. So I agree with him. I'm not smart enough to figure all that out. I understand the general theme. I understand the principle of what we need here. But when it comes to hammering legislation out, there's a reason why I just wear the same T-shirt every day. And I don't put on those expensive three-piece lawyer suits because that's not what I'm cut out for. But I do agree with the theme that it's needed if you want to keep college athletics in even somewhat of a classical model. Because I'll tell you why. I know people, I had a long conversation with someone yesterday who's kind of on the other side of this. And they said, you know what happens the moment you bring antitrust into this? You are essentially sounding a bullhorn for a bunch of lower-income kids, and you're telling them we are actively trying to stand between you and the ability for you to make money and create a better life for your family. And that probably is perception. It shouldn't be reality, though. You see, if I were to hammer things out, if I had my way, I would have the antitrust. I would have the ability to basically create college football as sort of a natural preserve within the city of American sporting society, because we understand there have to be some guardrails that protect this thing, or else it just gets swallowed immediately, because it would college football can't stand up to the free market. And so you have to choose whether you want it to exist or not. But even within a reworked antitrust situation, there's no way that I'm about to watch these billion-dollar TV deals get signed and not let those kids participate in revenue-sharing programs with those conferences. To me, that has to be a concession made. You cannot have kids not making any money after you've reworked your deal and you're signing television deals that dwarf whatever even you have made in the past. So I think there's a way to feed all the open mouths here. That's what I think there's a way to do if you have some common sense folks at the table.
Josh, if the two options in the future, crystal ball, are what you just described, which deals with Congress getting involved with antitrust legislation, or these student athletes becoming employees and some sort of salary cap literally being introduced into college football, which one do you think is more likely?
The first. I think the first one's more likely because I think that ultimately everyone is going to have to realize what the second one means. See, the second one sounds good if you can maintain status quo. If you could give those players employment status and everything else remains the same, well, I agree that would work out because then you can collectively bargain with them and then you can put them under contract and you don't have the transfer portal looking like it does right now. But see, here's what else that does. You have then injected true free market principles into college athletics. No one wants that. A lot of people think they want it, but no one wants to walk it through to its logical conclusion because, you see, when you do that, then you're also headed towards a world where there's no reason for the NCAA to exist, and there's no reason why those college football teams aren't then just split off to form their own entities. A lot of people think that sounds good, too. Continue to walk it through, though. Then they are not an attachment of those universities anymore. What they are is merely licensing those universities' brandings and essentially renting time in the college football stadiums every Saturday. And the most important part here is they then escape from under the umbrella of things like Title IX, and they don't have to adhere to that any longer. And if you want true free market, you need to understand that means that football is not subsidizing anything else at those universities anymore. They're just keeping the entire pie for themselves. So in an effort to fight for some players' rights, you have then sacrificed opportunities for infinitely thousands more college athletes in non-revenue-generating sports that only survive right now, whether it be in the pool or on the tennis court or on the golf course, because of football. So the collateral damage far outweighs whatever damage we think we're doing right now by maintaining somewhat of a classical model.
Good thing this isn't layered. You know, good thing this is a pretty easy issue to solve. Josh, we appreciate you making time for us. I hope you know that. Continued success, and hopefully we can talk again before the season.
I appreciate it, guys.
Josh Pate covers college football. Not sure anybody's doing it better on a daily basis these days than Josh Pate, 24/7 Sports, CBS Sports HQ, host of the Late Kick podcast.
To his last point, the university presidents will be kicking and screaming to allow them ever to become employees. It is the one factor that has to be accounted for, is that the ADs could all be on the same page. The university presidents are not all on the same page as the ADs.
It's kind of complicated. it was real easy to, you know, and this is why the NCAA completely screwed up for the last 10 years. They should have been able to see this coming.
We did. This was,
yes, and we're a couple of yahoos, and we saw it coming. How could they not? To those in Tampa, St. Pete, Lake City, Port Charlotte, and Venice, thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. The bonus hour of Miller and Moulton is next.